Good morning, everyone. Welcome to week two on the discussion of trauma. Today's topic is what defines you. Just before we start, I want to make an important save-the-date announcement. In a few weeks' time, just under 4 weeks, 4 weeks from yesterday, is Purim. Purim's on it. Have a seat, please. Purim is on a Wednesday this year. Sorry, on a Tuesday, I mean. Yeah, we ready? So, this year Purim's on a Tuesday. Now, when it's on a Thursday, it fits in well because we have our session anyways. But it's not. The Jewish calendar doesn't conform with my Thursday schedule. So, it's every day is different. So this year it's Tuesday, and I always like to emphasize that one of the most beautiful things about the Jewish experience is the Jewish calendar. And it's really, and every special day in the Jewish calendar has special energy, and it's really a pity to let it go by and not to notice it. Purim is a very, very powerful day. So I just want you to put it in your diaries for 9:30 on the 7th of March, on the Tuesday, not here, at the home of Ariella Spiridis in Vaucluse. So we'll be doing it there. Thursday will be Thursday. Thursday doesn't change. If you contact the office, I'll give you the address. No problem. Okay, so that's the Megillah and the Mitzvah Purim, a discussion about Purim as we always do. Okay. Quick Megillah, that is. Okay. So that's 7th of March. So just good to put it in diary now, so it's clear, so to speak. Just a quick review before we go into today's topic. So we talked about the fact that in the last number of decades, there's been a tremendous awareness risen on the topic of trauma. We talked about two different types of trauma, the big trauma, which is the one-off significant events, as literature tells us, that can be war, can be violence, abuse, accidents, and so on and so forth, that can cause the effect of trauma on the person. We have the concept which some refer to as complex trauma, which are small incidents but happen repeatedly, particularly in childhood between the birth and 15, things like neglect, detachment, toxic environments, and so on and so forth. But we did also talk about, a little bit went into the concept that it's important as the awareness grows and we get comfortable with the idea not to associate everything with trauma, because not every dysfunction is from trauma. It can be just regular life stress, which is normal stuff. And also remembering that not every weakness that we have and dysfunction that we have is definitely a result of trauma. It could just be a personality weakness that we were born with, because fundamental to Jewish thought, at least, is that we are born with strengths and we are born with weaknesses, and therefore we have all sorts of dispositions. And that's our life mission, to struggle with them a little bit and to overcome and to improve and to grow. Well, having said that, of course, as we said, trauma is a real thing. And the fact that in childhood, particularly trauma in childhood, can affect adult living is so accurate, of course, as we know this from Jewish early sources. We know this to be 100% true. There's such an emphasis on chinuch, on education in the Jewish world, specifically because... That's not to say adults shouldn't learn. Adults should learn. But I don't want to go out of business, so I'm just saying that. But the concept that what you say even to a very, very young child, even before they understand much, the Rambam brings from the Talmud that, like, when a child is born, as soon as they can start to talk, you repeat to them, you make them say, like, verses like the Shema and things like that. We have the custom that many people have that when a child is born, you surround them with verses of Tehillim, for example, because the environment of a child is so important. The Talmud talks about, I forget the name now, but the Talmud talks about a very, very great sage and praises his mother. And once asked his mother, what was the secret to your education of this child? She says that what I would do when he was very, very little, when he was still in the, what they call in Yiddish, the vigale, was still in the pram. What's it called here? Yeah, pram, right? I would take him to the Bet Midrash, I would take him to the study hall where the great sages were noisily learning, and I would let him rest there, I would let him take a nap there. So he would absorb the culture, the holiness, right? So we know this idea in a positive sense also, that what happens to a very young child affects what happens later on, and therefore same is true with trauma, complex trauma, ongoing neglect, ongoing detachment from parents and humiliation or whatever the trauma is can definitely have an effect on later on in life. And what is also, of course, true is that that trauma and that traumatic experience, whatever the trauma is, as we explained last week, has an effect in many different levels. So it affects the emotional stability of the person, and it also affects the body, the physical body, in many different ways. Illness, the way the brain works, the way the brain responds to outside stimulus, and so on and so forth. Gabor Mate has a very nice little saying, and he says, trauma is not what happens to you, it's what happens inside of you. You know, it's not about the trauma experience so much, it's more about the effect of trauma that lives on later. Okay. What I want to do today is begin with a question. So that's all good, we have an understanding of it, as we talked last week. But what do we do with it all? And of course, in the literature, there are much has been written about strategy, about therapies, different types of therapies. There are a few interesting normative sort of therapies. There's a few lately. Maybe we'll get to it towards the end. There's some real controversial therapies that are becoming popular, which maybe we'll talk about as we go along. And that's all important. But the truth is the following. The truth is that before one can heal from trauma, and before one can really heal from any challenge, that's the truth, or from any traumatic experience. And what I'm about to say is not only relevant to trauma, it's relevant to really any challenge or significant experience that we have. We need to create a foundation. And the foundation is, number one, that trauma or any other challenges can happen to us, and they do happen to us. The question we have to ask ourselves is, do they define us? Right, and that's really today's topic. Defines us means it becomes who we are. It becomes our frame of reference. It becomes the foundation and the context in everything that we do and everything we experience. Now, the answer is that it shouldn't define us, and that's the point that we have to build as a foundational principle. And we have to make that choice. It's a choice. We have to make that choice for the trauma not to define us. We need to recognize that it's there. We need to recognize and be aware and raise the awareness of the effects of the trauma. We have to diagnose it or have it diagnosed. But it doesn't have to, but after all of that, it doesn't have to define us and shouldn't define us. Why? Because let's begin with a very, very fundamental principle. You know, we're looking through Jewish eyes a little bit, so we need to talk about a very, very fundamental principle, two principles in very early Jewish thinking, which is as relevant today as it always was. And that is, number one, that fundamental to Jewish belief is that we're all born with a purpose, right? It's not random. We're born with a purpose. And we have to try as best as we can throughout our lives to live by that purpose. Now, of course, the Torah gives us a set of principles and values between man and man, between man and God, of principles that we should try and live by, but in that itself, there's obviously different ways of applying it. And different people can apply it and achieve their purpose or mission or enter into an occupation or be involved in a particular project in different ways. So we have the foundations that Torah gives us, but then we do with it, we apply it in different ways. The principles are the same, but we apply it in different ways. And we try to live our life with the Jewish guidance, with the Torah guidance, but we try to live our life for meaning and for purpose. That's the foundation. The second is that because we are created for purpose, purpose means we need to choose a life of purpose. The second principle is that we all have, each one of us, have something that the sources refer to as bechira. Bechira is free choice. Right? Now, we've talked about this a lot in the past. What I mean by free choice is we don't have free choice to control the world, because actually we don't have anything. We don't have any choice when it comes to controlling the world, because fundamental Jewish belief is that God controls everything. He just doesn't control our choices. By his choice, he doesn't control our choices. He leaves the choices up to us. He leaves our response to life up to us. Right? In other words, when someone experiences something like trauma, we're going to break this down and explain it a little bit, right? We have to choose. It's not easy, and it's not an easy road, not an easy journey, depending on the significant size or magnitude of the traumatic experience. But when someone experiences trauma, we need to make a commitment not to become a victim to that trauma. We have to know it, recognize it, understand it, feel the pain of it, but not to become a victim of it, right? And just to, we're going to explain a bit more in a minute, but just to go back to, you know, something that, I've forgotten the author's name now, I think it was, anyway, the book that I mentioned last week, The End of Trauma. He says that one of the problems that PTSD has been turned into a condition, which it wasn't until 20, 30 years ago. He said the problem with that is that when it becomes a diagnosable medical disease, it's like you either have it or you don't have it. If you don't have it, you don't have to worry about it. If you have it, then it's like you, right? Then it becomes you kind of thing. He calls it a rigid essentialist assumption. Right, and that shouldn't be true because it's actually not that way. We might have it, and it might be big, but it's not like a sore throat that you don't have a choice to get rid of it or not. I mean, unless you take medicine, of course. But right, it's something that we can respond to, and it's something that we can choose not to become a victim of. Right. Let me just go back for a few minutes to Edith Eger, one of my favorite authors. You remember that we did a whole series on the book called The Gift, right? And in The Gift, she has a chapter on not being a victim, but she also in her opening introduction, she says, "Remembering my mother's advice, no one can take from you what you put into your mind. I closed my eyes and retreated to an inner world." And then she goes on to explain that, and later she says the following, a very strong statement that only someone like her could say, or someone that's experienced something like her could say, right? So I'm just quoting her. I'm not saying it. I'm quoting her. She says, "I'm here to tell you that the worst prison is not the one the Nazis put me in. The worst prison is the one I built for myself." And she says, "This book is a practical guide to help us identify our mental prisons and develop the tools we need to become free." Very powerful words, right? Extremely powerful words. Now, of course, what this does is we need to understand this a little bit. Because mental illness and trauma certainly becomes part of mental illness. It's a real mental condition, the effects of trauma, I should say, if it's true trauma, right? Certainly weakens our choice. So what does it mean that we have a choice? What does that actually mean, right? So first of all, let's understand that this concept of bechira, this concept of choice, what it does, and Jewish literature is full of this, it places a huge responsibility on the human being. Which we know, part of Jewish thinking is, not always in line with modern thinking, part of Jewish, fundamental Jewish thinking is that the person, unless they're completely insane and psychotic, that's different. There's a category in the Talmud called a shoteh, which in modern Hebrew means a fool, but in Talmudic Hebrew means someone who is actually mentally incapable and dysfunctional completely, and the Talmud goes through a whole understanding to define that and what that means, and in modern Jewish law, it's very relevant in terms of lots of things, like validity of transactions, sometimes divorce laws, in all sorts, and obligation to keep the Torah, mitzvot, and so on. So we know that a shoteh, someone who's clinically insane or psychotic and has no mental ability to make decisions, has no responsibility. That is true. There are people like that. Obviously, the theological question is, why did God create people like that? And that's a different discussion. But obviously, they have a purpose just by existing, but they do not have responsibility, just as a small child doesn't have responsibility, right? However, beyond that definition, Jewish thinking doesn't not recognize mental challenge, but nevertheless still places the bechira, still places the responsibility of choice on the human being in a very, very emphatic way, right? Just to give you an example, in ancient times, when murder was a capital offense in Jewish thought, right? When there was a Beit Din in Israel and so on, and the Torah does have capital punishment, and there are a few transgressions that are capital punishment, and murder is one of them. Now, it's actually very difficult to convict someone in Torah law for murder punishment, just the concept, right? Because there's a lot of interrogation and it's quite hard. There can't be circumstantial evidence, has to be witnesses, the witnesses have to have warned the person, so it's not easy for a person to actually get the capital punishment, but just But just in principle, right? In principle, if someone rocks up or someone is arrested and comes to the court of Jewish law and is tried for murder, for example, right? And it's absolutely beyond any doubt, not a reasonable doubt, because you have to actually have eyewitnesses. It's been established that, in fact, he is guilty of murder. His circumstance in terms of how he grew up and his and how he was treated as a child and his toxic environment of parents, and you can go on and on with the list, it makes no difference at the end of the day. That's the Jewish thinking, because the person ultimately has a choice. Now, we need to understand what that means. Because it's certainly true. In fact, I wanted to get this clear in my own mind yesterday, and I called Dr. Pelkowitz just to discuss this with him to make sure I was on the right track here. So, right? I mean, I kind of always thought this was the case. I wanted to just clear it with someone who's both very knowledgeable in Jewish thinking and in mental health. So he talked to me, yeah, he was fully on board with this concept that responsibility in Jewish law and free choice is tremendous. The difference is like this. The free choice lives in a different context from situation to situation. It's always there, but lives in context. So, for example, if I'm born, if I'm a regular person, just born with the regular weaknesses that, you know, God gives us all, and I don't know, I like to waste time, or I like to indulge in things that I shouldn't indulge in, right? So I have a choice. Torah says, you, good and bad, you choose good. Ah, it's difficult? Okay, so go to a shiur and learn about it. Inspire yourself, read good stories, and make the right choices. However, we know that there are some times that's just simply insufficient. So, for example, if someone has a real addiction, right, which often is related to trauma, as we said last week, right? Not always, but often. So we know that, as Rabbi Twersky points out in great length, if someone has a real addiction, I'm sort of a diagnosable addiction, coming to a Thursday morning shiur or coming to 20 shiurim or going to, it's not going to help. They need something much, much different. Why? Because their bechira, their choice, has been damaged. So then how can we say they have bechira then? How can we say they're not insane, they're not psychotic. So how can we say they have a choice? The choice shifts to a different perspective. The choice means that you still need to know that you are responsible for yourself. The shiurim is not going to work, the chumash is not going to work, go to a professional. Get the professional help that you need. Go to a 12-step program. Go and get the help that you actually need. Right? Now again, I want to make this very clear. We're not talking about if someone has a physiological illness, which often results in mental illness. Physiological illness, the choice is also to get help and to go to a professional, but it doesn't always work. Just like, God forbid, if someone has cancer, it doesn't always work to go to the doctor, unfortunately. And the same thing is with mental illness that comes from physiological circumstances, which are often the case. And mental illness is an illness, so therefore it doesn't always. But the choice is you need to take responsibility and to seek all levels of support that is available to you. You cannot put your hands up and say, well, this is my condition. Right? Just as a person would never do that in any physical illness. Right? So that's a very, very important thing to understand. Now we're going to come back in a second to collective responsibility. But this is I just want to lay that foundation. It's a very, very important foundation. The responsibility that a person has not to become a victim to their circumstance, not to become a victim to the things that shaped their personality or that had an effect on them, right? Which is, again, going back to Edith Eger's work, it's the basis of what she said. Now, because it expressed itself in different components, different ideas. So again, in her introduction, she says something very beautiful. I did this when we did the gift, but I want to just remind you because it's such an important context. Because right? When she wrote this book, it was based on this principle, and she said, therefore, what she did was, she based the discussion on four psychological principles. The first one was the work of Martin Seligman, which Martin Seligman talks about positive psychology, one of the fathers of positive psychology. If only we could bring back Martin Seligman and Edith Eger to become the literature of the time instead of the more recent stuff. Anyway, because they're so good. But anyway, Martin Seligman talks about learned helplessness, right? He says that people sometimes develop a condition called learned helplessness. They talk themselves into that they're helpless and they become helpless, right? And he said, which is a known thing in teaching, education, we know about learned helplessness, right? But he says the same thing is true with positive. He said you can have learned optimism. Now, it's true, some people are more optimistic than others, just the way we're born. But he professes, and he's 100% right, particularly in line with Jewish ideas, that there is a concept of learned optimism. As she puts it, the strength, the resiliency, the ability to create the meaning and direction of our lives. For some of us, it's very difficult, but it's possible. And that's what we have to remember that. And the reason I'm going in this today is because when we talk about the strategies or the therapies that are available for trauma, none of it will work unless these foundations are there. You have to really believe that you can heal. You have to believe that it's in your hands, right? So the first thing is learned optimism, the works of Martin Seligman. The second is the cognitive behavioral therapy that she uses so much, which is based on the principle that the mind, the thoughts, create our feelings. Right? Otherwise known in the book of Tanya as Moach Shalit al Alev, an age-old Jewish principle, the brain rules the heart. So the more we think, the more we internalize, the more we connect to the ideas, the more the ideas become who we are and we start to feel them. The third principle, and we're going to come back to this a little bit later towards the end, is the principle of unconditional positive self-regard. Now, just note, we're talking about positive self-regard, not positive complete acceptance. Not self-acceptance to the extreme. It's very different, as we'll soon see. Right? But we do need to understand that we accept the condition that we have. We regard our intrinsic value notwithstanding the weaknesses that we have, notwithstanding the trauma that we have, notwithstanding the difficulties and the challenges that we've experienced. We're still a human being. We still have intrinsic worth. We still have self-worth. And therefore, we can overcome it. And therefore, we can continue on that journey. And the last principle, she says, is that she learned from her friend and mentor, Viktor Frankl, that our worst experiences can be our best teachers. Right? See, part of living a life of meaning and purpose is that everything that happens can then be turned into a piece of the puzzle of meaningful living. That's so important. Which goes, of course, links to the whole idea of Hashgacha Pratit, that everything that happens to us ultimately can be used. Because we are supposed to live a life of purpose, therefore if something happens to us that is negative, and it is negative, trauma is a negative thing, but nevertheless, it can become our best mentors, it can become our best teacher, because we can then not just bounce back from it, but actually become stronger. In other words, if it happened to us, then that can become part of our life of meaning and our life of purpose. Okay. She in a chapter of victimhood, she says, again, I want to quote this, I did this before, but she says, suffering is universal, but victimhood is optional. Right? So it's really our choice whether we become victim. What happens to us is not in our control. Again, I mean, if we believe in Jewish thinking, that's for sure not in our control. Right? It's definitely not random. Whether we like it or not, and whether we wanted it to happen or not, that's irrelevant. But it's not in our control. And therefore, that's not optional. And unfortunately, it is still here until Mashiach comes. Suffering exists for reasons we don't always understand. But victimhood is optional. That's our choice. Now, I want to just emphasize this idea and sort of how sometimes it's more difficult than others, but yet it's always there. First of all, just to quote two things. I want to quote a passage from the Rambam. Maimonides, the great philosopher, the great Jewish philosopher and doctor, there's one chapter where he talks about free choice. Right? And he says the following. He says that free choice is linked to purpose. Why? Because he says, and I'm going to just paraphrase and translate, he says, because there's a passage in the Talmud which says that before a person is born, the angel in charge of this particular person's birth comes to God and says, should this person be like strong or weak, wealthy or not wealthy, clever or not so clever, you know, what should his mental capability, right? All these things. But not once does the malach, does the ask, should be a righteous person or an evil person. Why? Because that's up to the person, right? That's free choice. Says the Rambam, if God would decree upon the person whether to be a tzaddik or a rasha, a righteous or an evil person, or we would just accept that there's something within the birth of the person that is pulling him or her to ways which are not appropriate. As he says, the fools of our time have created in their own heart this nonsense. that, you know, it's circumstantial, scientific. You just, that's the way you're born and that's it, right? He says, it's such a silly thing to think that, because then how could God possibly give us a Torah which has principles and values which we have to live by? In other words, what he's really saying is, there will be no purpose to life, and you couldn't direct a person to live a certain way in a meaningful way if it's all predetermined. So what's the point then? Right? So therefore, he's sort of strengthened this idea.
So he doesn't think it's predetermined.
Our response to life.
Yeah,
no, life, the circumstance, well, not predetermined scientifically, it's predetermined, in other words, the way, how your day turns out is up to God. And it could change, by the way, depending on what we do. Sometimes God, we will pray and God will say, okay, I'll make your day a bit different. Sometimes not. Right? But that's up to God. That God makes happen, right? But how we cope with it, how we respond to it, is totally our choice. Otherwise, there's no purpose to life. There's no point being here. Otherwise, it's random. Right? Now, there's a fascinating idea, just to, again, going back to what we said before, that there's always free choice, just sometimes a little bit harder. There's a fascinating idea, a famous theological question that comes up in the story of Exodus, right? A couple of months is Purim, Pesach, I mean. So, there were 10 plagues in Egypt, the whole thing, right? And one of the things that God keeps on telling Moses is, or the Torah says, that after each plague, God hardens Pharaoh's heart, right? And one place that it's said in very sort of emphatic terms, just before the third to last plague. God says to Moses, there's a verse in the Torah where God says to Moses, I'm going to share with you the idea and then relate it back to what we said before about trauma. God says to Moses, go to Pharaoh and warn him that there's going to be, if you don't send the Jewish people away, tomorrow there's going to be eighth plague of locusts, right? And in that sentence, when God is communicating to Moses to go and tell the Pharaoh this, he says, "Ki ani hichbaditi et libo." I have hardened his heart. In other words, there's not such a big chance he's going to let you go. But tell him, warn him, you better let us go. If you don't, there's going to be locusts. So if you just take the translation of that verse, just that verse itself, it seems grossly unfair. Right? In other words, you can't have it both ways. If you've hardened his heart, then it's not his fault. If he has choice, then don't harden his heart, right? So there's much has been written on this topic, but the Lubavitcher Rebbe once gave a talk and he said the following. His the purpose of the talk was to draw a lesson for us, that if this can be true with Pharaoh, how much more so can be true with us? And he quotes an interesting passage in the Talmud that says the following. You know, we have this idea called tshuva, right? That no matter what you do, no matter how bad you were, you can always return, you can always come back, you can always improve, you can always ask for forgiveness, right? And yet, there are sometimes the Talmud says that in certain circumstances, God is going to block, as a punishment, God is going to block the ways of repentance. I'll give you an example. So it says, if someone takes us very lightly and he says, you know what, I'm just going to do something bad because I'll do tshuva. I'll have a good time today and tomorrow I'll do tshuva, right? So that's not acceptable. It says the Talmud, if you do that, it's called Echtave Ashuv. I'm going to sin and then I'm going to do Shuvah. If you do that, En Maspikin Beyado. They don't give him the opportunity to do Shuvah. It's going to be very difficult to do Shuvah. Almost like as a punishment. You can't just, Shuvah is a thing that you try to do the right thing and you didn't do it. You know, okay, so, but to do an evil thing with the intention afterwards to do Shuvah, that's just not acceptable. So he quotes from the book of the Tanya, that says that is true, that it'll be very difficult to do tshuva. However, even such a person, tshuva is not impossible. Even such a person, the language of the Tanya is dachak v'nichnas. If you really try, and you put in humongous effort, even that person could do tshuva. Right? We have this. There's a story in the Talmud about a great sage. It's the only time we find this in Talmudic history. Two times we find it, but the great sage that became a heretic, his name was Acher, became a heretic. He started exploring inappropriate sort of mystical thing, and he became a heretic. And the Talmud, he was the teacher before he became a heretic. He was the teacher of a great sage called Rabbi Meir, who's buried, I think, in Tveria. And the Talmud says that even after his teacher became a heretic, Rabbi Meir continued to learn from him, which Talmud discusses, how can you do that? Torah is not an academic subject. You have to learn from someone who lives it, not to someone who's discarded, disbanded it. Okay, so the Talmud says Rabbi Meir was different because he knew how to sift. He knew how to take the good and leave the bad. Okay. So one time they were talking together, they were walking, and towards the end of Acher's life, and Rabbi Meir turns to his teacher and he says, Chazor b'cha, do tshuva. Repent. Don't die a heretic. Come back. Come back home. And he says, I can't. He says, what do you mean you can't? Why? He says, because I heard me'acharei ha'pargut. When I was traversing the upper realms, the heavenly spheres, I heard a voice from the other side of a screen saying, Shuvu banim shavavim, return my naughty children, chutz ma'acher, except for acher. I heard a voice that I won't be able to do tshuva. Now, Rabbi Meir was a very great sage. What did he respond? He should have said, oh, I didn't realize it. I'm sorry. I won't bother you anymore. He didn't. He grabbed him and he said, I'm taking you to the shul. You've got to do tshuva. And there's a whole, it's not clear the end of the story. There's a whole difference of opinion among the commentaries. Some say that in fact he did do tshuva towards the very end of his life. Some say not, but there's a difference of opinion. And the obvious question is, what do you mean? He said he heard a heavenly voice saying that everyone can do tshuva except for him. So why is Rabbi Meir persisting? And the answer is, it doesn't exist such a concept. If you heard a heavenly voice, what the heavenly voice meant is that it's going to be very difficult for you. When God says he hardened Pharaoh's heart, he means he's going to make it difficult for him. Why did he make it difficult for him? Where's the fairness in that? The answer is because he had repeatedly transgressed so many times. He repeatedly refused to let the Jewish people go, and he repeatedly persecuted them to such a degree that part of the punishment was, well, then it's going to be difficult for you to return, but not impossible. Difficult, but not impossible. In other words, that's how powerful this concept of Bechira is. That although sometimes there are things that stand in our way and they're real, it doesn't make it impossible. And I think I want to relate that back to the concept of trauma. Trauma is real. The effects of trauma are real. And sometimes the person who has suffered significant trauma, whether be it big trauma or complex trauma, the Bechira, the free choice, is more difficult. They need more support. They need more strategies. They need different kinds of intervention. But the point of choice is still there. The choice not to become a victim to who we are is still there. Now, we shouldn't, this is more we're saying for ourselves. Obviously, we shouldn't judge others, we should support others. But the point is still there. Now, when I talk about others, let me just bring this in, and this is, I think, an important concept, right? That's not just, this choice is not just individual responsibility. I'm very, as you can probably tell, I'm very passionate about this idea, partly because society is going the other way around, right? And it's really scary, I think. It's really, really scary. The concept that you are, and don't worry, this is the way you're made, this is the way you are, this is just accept me and finish, and the whole business, right? It's very, very scary, and it's going to raise a generation of I don't know what, right? Just that the concept of blaming, as I said last week, people cut off their parents because they didn't like what they said or how they brought them up, even if it was traumatic. I'm not talking about, you know, there's certain exceptions, but right, as I said last week, none of us are perfect. We all made mistakes. We're all going to make mistakes, right? Things do happen. And, you know, I go back to Edith Eger. I mean, you can't get more trauma than that, what these people experienced, right? And yet, they did make that choice and preached the concept of making that choice. That's why I said I wish that literature would be much more of the curriculum today, because this is what we need to be teaching children right from day one, that you do have a choice. Your behavior, at the end of the day, is your choice. Now, if you suffer trauma, it becomes much more difficult. Correct. But the choice is still there. And as a society, we have a responsibility, right, to support that choice and to encourage that choice. And what I mean by that is, and this is something Dr. Pelkowitz told me yesterday on the phone, he said, when someone else has trauma, you need to have empathy. You need to not judge. You need to, what he called in Hebrew, noseh ba'olim chaviro, you need to really feel for the person. But still encourage the person to move on. Encourage the person to make the right choice. They're two different things. Right? Sometimes if we think if we encourage a person not to get stuck, we're being judgmental, we're not. And we should never be, God forbid, we should never judge anyone for anything. Because we don't know people's circumstances and their philosophies and what they've been educated and what they went through. We'll never understand the trauma. And therefore, those people who don't manage to become unstuck from their trauma or free themselves from their trauma, they're beyond judgment. We can never judge it. But what we should be doing as a society, we should be encouraging that concept of choice. And it's particularly true when it comes to these ideas, because when it comes to mental weakness or mental challenge, like trauma, part of the problem with choice is that part of the problem why it becomes more difficult, not only because of the effects of trauma, but also when someone is going through a mental challenge, the mental capacity of choice lives in the brain. So therefore, to make that choice is more difficult. And sometimes we need to be the ones encouraging to make that choice. We need to be saying, no, you could do this. And I'm going to help you get help and get the right intervention, because it is possible. And if you don't think it's possible, we need to make you aware that it's possible. Right? Because when we see someone going through a challenge, again, we should not judge them. We should recognize it, and it's real, and we should understand it and have empathy. But we should never define not ourselves and not other people by their challenge. Right? You know, I'll give you an interesting example for this, where it seems very obvious to society, and yet in these kind of things doesn't seem always obvious. There's been, in education, for example, there's been in the last number of decades amazing progress made in the areas of education, the areas of dealing with learning difficulties, and so on and so forth, right? Differentiation mechanisms and really getting people to very strong levels of education despite that they were born with certain processing difficulties, right? So imagine, you know, you have a child, right? He's got a learning difficulty, what they used to call dyslexia, or they call other things, whatever, different names for it nowadays, whatever it is, right? Do we just say, as we used to say back home, ach shame, that's the way you're born and that's it, finished? So you won't be able to achieve what everyone else achieves. We don't do that. We push. We say, you got to try your best. We've got to find different ways. If you can't do it this way, we're going to find you different supportive mechanisms. But we want you to try and learn to read. We want you to try and study. We want you to try and understand. Some people, there's certain conditions they have, maybe they won't get to the level that we think they can, but the founding principle is we try and say the goals we expect from everyone, maybe not at the same level, but similar goals. We're not going to say, well, no, you shouldn't be educated, you know, just because you find it more difficult. We don't do that. Society doesn't do that. We've invested so much effort, and some have at least. We've invested so much effort and so much technique and so much money and so many resources into saying we can do it a different way. We can teach you a different way. We can employ a different method. We can at least bring you to some level of decent education or decent functionality. We're not going to just resign ourselves to this, is because we're going to bring, right? So as a society, we should be doing the same thing, even more, when it comes to people overcoming their challenges and overcoming things like trauma. Despite the fact that it's difficult. Again, based on this principle that we have a choice. We have bechira. Bechira means that we have a bechira not to be defined by the trauma. And no healing can actually begin until we understand these two principles. That we have a purpose and that we have a choice to make that purpose happen. Context might shift. The way we apply the free choice might be a bit different, but it's always possible. Now, let's just go back a little bit to those four things that Edith Eger talked about, right? So, the fact that we can learn helplessness, learned optimism, I mean. The brain is ruling the heart, right? Our thoughts, education, learning. The last one was that we take challenging circumstances and turn them into teachers. And then the third one was positive self-regard, right? So here comes... This is very, very important, and I want to just go into this a little bit. Because the confusion comes, you know, when I talk about the more modern literature, which I sometimes dislike, in case you haven't noticed, sometimes I like it very much, but sometimes I don't like it so much, right? The reason that it happens is because, can we put back the thing? It's really hot in here. Right, thanks. The reason that the problem comes because there's a big confusion, right? And it goes back to the pendulum syndrome I always talk about, right? See, what's happening today a lot with self-acceptance and the overuse of self-love and so on is a reaction to a generation that didn't know how to express emotions and ignored their emotions, right? You see, even going back, then again, with no judgment whatsoever, we know there were lots of people who went through, for example, went through the Holocaust, right? And that's just, I mean, it's unimaginable trauma. And not everyone healed as well as Edith Eger or Viktor Frankl, right? And when we talk about the people who didn't heal as well, we also know that they didn't necessarily retreat into dysfunctionality. They actually got on with their lives, and they achieved, appears to have achieved a lot of good things. But they often didn't deal with their stuff. They didn't deal with their pain. One of the big themes in Edith's book is not to become a victim, but at the same time, her big theme is you've got to deal with the pain, you've got to confront the pain, right? And that's and there's a huge reaction to that today. There's a huge reaction to that in parenting, how you have to let children express their feelings and have healthy emotions and so on and so forth. So that's true, and that's good. However, there's two mistakes that are made, I think. And obviously I'm using my perspective of Jewish thinking in this, right? It is absolutely important to recognize the emotion. They use it now, there's a line they use now in educating kids, you've got to name it to tame it, right? So you can't deal with it unless you actually know what it is, right? So you know, Susan David, everyone knows Susan David, she talks about this a lot. She's a South African, she started this movement called Emotional Agility. And, you know, she talks about when bad things happen and it's tough, it's been a tough day and so on and so forth. And people tell you, you know, you've got to get on with it, you've got to be positive and so on and so forth, right? So she says, why do we so often feel the impulse to insist that things are in fact not that bad? Which is a good question. We don't have to always think things are bad, right? That things are good, I mean. Because being positive doesn't mean everything's wonderful. It's not. And she says, I call this the tyranny of positivity. Okay. It's a strong language. I didn't know positivity was tyrannical, but anyways, okay. She wants to make a point, I get that. Right. I mean, she does qualify later. She's not anti-happiness. She's actually very for happiness, but she doesn't like forced happiness. She says, I'm not anti-happiness. I'm anti-forced happiness. Okay. Then she makes a statement which I don't think is true, and this is the point I want to make, one of the points. While some emotions are certainly more pleasurable than others, it is counterproductive to think of them as being good or bad. I don't think that's correct. There's a big movement today that every emotion is good. Gabor Mate is a big believer in this, right? That every emotion is good, and that kids have a need to express all emotions. They should express anger and hate and revenge and all good things, right? I see, again, this is the pendulum problem of responding to a generation that suppressed their emotions, right? I don't know why, in order to feel emotions, you have to label the emotion as being good. Some emotions are clearly not good. Now, they might be in essence good, you can channel them to something good, but they're not good the way they are, right? So when a child or an adult, therefore, has this unbelievable surge of jealousy towards someone else, or you have this feeling of strong hate toward another person, most of you wouldn't have had that feeling probably, but I know what it is, right? If you had that feeling, strong feeling of hate towards another person, that feeling is not good. It's bad. It's bad. It's just, it is what it is. It's bad. It's a negative emotion. It's a toxic emotion. Now, it doesn't mean I don't like myself if I have such an emotion, right? I can still have positive self-regard. I just think I'm normal. That's all. I'm normal. If I ever feel that I want to lose my temper with someone, I'm normal. To pretend that I don't think, that I pretend that emotion doesn't exist is being silly. But to pretend that it's good is also being silly, because it's not good. You get me? So in other words, part of the movement of expressing emotion is important, but we have to understand what it is. And it goes very much to the whole concept of trauma, because part of the healing of trauma is that choice, that foundation of choice. Part of the foundation of choice is that we're not perfect, and we don't respond to everything properly. And the effects of trauma have been that I'm responding very negatively. So I have to build up, I have to first of all confront the pain. I have to know that it's there. But in that pain that I confront, which Edith Eger does amazingly, right? In her writings, she recognizes that she has pain, because to pretend we don't have pain is silly. And part of trauma healing means to recognize the trauma, to understand that it happened, to understand why things are happening on the basis of that trauma, but also recognize that I'm perfectly normal for responding that way. My dysfunction currently is perfectly normal. I still am a person with tremendous self-worth and intrinsic value. I'm a person who can overcome it. But overcoming it means I name it, I understand what it is, but then I work to overcome it and to discard it. Because it's actually bad. Because I don't have to be perfect. But I have to work and take responsibility for my imperfections. That's a very different thing. Right? So therefore, it's something that I've shared with you many times, that anxiety is not good, or worry, excessive worry is not good. I know that everyone in this room has had it, because you're Jewish, so you must have had anxiety, right? Hate, I don't know, but anxiety for sure, right? So worry is not worry is a bad thing. So the pasuk King Solomon says, "Da'aga belev ish." I've said this many times. If you have a worry in the heart of a person, yashchena. The word yashchena in Hebrew has two meanings: speak about it to someone else or discard it. In other words, walking around with worry in your heart, recognize that it's there, understand the emotion, it is there, but it is not good. So you've got to do two things. Either you've got to express to someone else to get it off your chest, or discard it in your brain. Or perhaps the interpretation is that they go together. You have to talk to someone about it so that you can discard it. Right? Big difference. So when we talk about feeling emotion, right, the important thing to understand is this. The alternative to emotion suppression is not emotion acceptance. Right? Now, you won't see that in all literature, but trust me. Right? The alternative to emotion suppression is not emotional acceptance. It's understanding that the difference between a good emotion and a normal emotion. But that normal emotion is toxic and needs to be worked with. Right? It's like I said to you many, many weeks ago about the child, about the mother who said to the child, "I can see it's very difficult for you to share, and I accept that and I recognize that, and therefore you don't have to share." Now that's rubbish. But people are doing this to themselves also. I mean, we don't have to become saints overnight, obviously, right? But if I have an emotion, if I'm a hateful person or a jealous person, or I have a problem with a certain emotion, whether it's because of normal birth or because of traumatic experiences, I do need to accept it, meaning I accept it in the sense that I have to recognize it. I have to recognize it, that it's there. I have to recognize that it's a negative thing, and I have to go on a journey to not respond to it with toxicity, but to channel it into something positive or to discard or whatever the case is. And that's part of the bechira, part of the choice. Because I'm not defined by my emotions. It is important not to suppress my emotions. And yes, healing cannot begin. One of the things also we need for the process of healing is to recognize, to accept that I have these emotions, not to suppress them, not to ignore them, not to believe that the world is just a wonderful place and everything's wonderful and fantastic, because it isn't. Right? I had a conversation yesterday with someone. At the beginning it was about something else totally, but I knew the person was going through a bit of a tough time. So at the beginning of the conversation, I said, pleasantries. It was on phone. I said, How are you? I'm thinking, I'm fine. How's your family? All good. Then we had the conversation. I said, okay, now I asked you that question at the beginning because I want to be nice. Now tell me really how you are. Yeah. Right? And the answer is, no, I'm not so good, right? And I said that. And that's okay. And that's honest. And it's okay to be legitimately vulnerable, as Renee Brown talks about, within reason, right? Not to become needy, as we talked about when we talk about vulnerability. Needy is not a good thing, but vulnerable is a good thing, to show up completely, to be honest with ourselves and to share it with those who we need to share it with, and to recognize that it exists, but not to accept it as a good thing, because being a good person doesn't mean that I'm perfect. And being a good person doesn't mean that every part of my consciousness is good, because it's not. That's an angel, and angels aren't good things necessarily. I mean, they're holy things, but they're not people. People are much greater, as we've said hundreds of times. People are born imperfect, intrinsically imperfect. We're pure, our soul is pure. But our consciousness is good and bad, and that's okay. That's normal. So we've got to accept the good for what it is, we've got to recognize the bad, and then work with it. So I wanted to make that idea because that is part of Edith Eger's book, in terms of not becoming a victim. One of those four components is self-regard, and accepting the pain, absolutely important, but not becoming defined by the pain, right? So let me just finish with one sentence that she said, which I think is unbelievable. Because when we tap into when we start the healing process, right? Because what we're going to talk about in the coming week is also tapping into the knowing that we have the choice is part one, but then where do we find that choice? In other words, in order to make that choice to bounce back, to heal from challenge, to heal from trauma, we also need to find the part within us that can help us do it, which is the strength of resilience. Besides the therapies and the strategies and so on, we have to find that point of resilience, and that's what we're going to try and discuss in the coming weeks. But as Edith Eger said, I'll just end with this quote. She says, because I talked about Bechira being responsibility, right? She says, we can be wounded and accountable at the same time. Responsible and innocent. We can give up the secondary gains of victimhood for the primary gains of growing and healing and moving on. Beautiful quote. Because becoming a victim seems often the safe way, the easy way out. It feels safe. People do this for a reason. She explains this a lot in her book. People define themselves by their trauma, by their negativity, by their toxicity for a reason. Because it feels better, it's safer, it's easier. I have what to blame it on, I have a way to explain it. But as she says, we have to give up the secondary gains of victimhood for the primary gains of growing and healing and moving on, which is not easy. It's hard work, but it's possible. We'll continue next week. Oh.